Wicked Cool Feature Alert.
Hey there, podcast fans. Thanks for listening. Now, you can also reach out and send me a text message. On every episode, at the top of the show notes, you'll see a link that says, Send Us a Text Message. Simply click it, write something super nice and sweet, and away we go. Also remember to please subscribe, share this podcast with a friend by telling them about it, and leave us a positive review, whether it's on Apple, Spotify, your favorite podcast streaming service, or even on our website at www.afraidofnothingpodcast.com. You know, some shows the universe just sends your way, and that just so happens to be the case with tonight's show. Former colleague, good friend, Tricia Wilson told me about a woman named Perdita Finn and thought she'd be great to have on the show, and lo and behold, she was. It's an excellent episode. A little bit about Perdita. She's the co-founder with her husband, Clark Strand, of the non-denominational international fellowship, The Way of the Rose, which inspired their book, The Way of the Rose, The Radical Path of the Divine Feminine Hidden in the Rosary. In addition to extensive study with Zen masters, priests, rabbis, shamans, and healers, Perdita apprenticed with the psychic Susan Saxman, with whom she wrote The Reluctant Psychic, a great title, by the way. Perdita now teaches popular workshops on getting to know the dead, in which participants are empowered to activate the magic in their own lives with the help of their ancestors. She lives with her family in the moss-filled shadows of the Catskill Mountains.
In a world where nothing is known, nothing is certain, reality is not real. Wake up! Be afraid of nothing. I'm Bob Heskey.
Robert.
The host with the ghost.
This is my podcast, based on my paranormal documentary, Afraid of Nothing. Each episode, we talk to people who see life and the afterlife through a different lens. Join me.
Who is this large man? And what's he doing in our bedroom?
As we lift the veil and open our minds to see beyond our eyes lie. This is Afraid of Nothing.
Nothing.
We have a guest tonight that was actually brought to me from a friend, a former colleague named Tricia Wilson, but I'm so happy she did. We have with us tonight Perdita Finn, which is one of the great names of all my guests. I mean, it's a great name for an author, which Perdita is, but it's also, I mean, I could almost see it as like a sleuth, like in an English Hamlet, Perdita. I mean, I love that. I love your name, and I love that you're here with me tonight.
Well, thank you, Robert. My name is from Shakespeare, but it's a play nobody reads. And my father, who was a lapsed Irish Catholic, he used to tell people that what could you name somebody born in the 20th century other than perdition? So that was a delight. But I've learned to deal with my name.
Oh, it's a great name. It's a great name. It ended up being a blessing. So you have many skills. So look, we're going to touch on probably a couple tonight, but you're an author, you're a teacher. Would you say that you're a psychic or an empath or an intuitive? What would you say your abilities are?
You know what? I'm an ordinary person, and I wrote a book with an extraordinary psychic, and I number among my friends really powerful psychics and seers. And I don't see dead people or hear dead people. But what I do is have a very profound, intimate relationship with them that I believe is available to everyone. And in fact, I believe that everyone is psychic, except we express our psychic abilities in very, very different ways and have different skill sets. Part of my teaching is to help people know how open the dead are to communication, conversation, and collaboration.
I got to tell you, I mean, I've listened to you on several podcasts and a lot of your messages. I'm assuming you're definitely a believer in reincarnation, that we live many lives. I love one of your messages that we're not going anywhere.
It's the first law of the conservation of matter. You know, and nothing goes anywhere. Not energy, not matter. Yeah, I don't know that I believe in reincarnation. I have really had profound experiences of it my whole life.
You believe, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you believe that we have many existences, mm-hmm. and it's just an ongoing kind of lesson that we're learning. Is that accurate?
Oh, I hope it's not a lesson that we're learning. I really okay. do. I hope it's a dance we're all dancing together.
Wow, that's even better.
Erotic, erotic dance of love. How about that?
That sounds good.
Can we do that and maybe get out of the classroom and just have some fun?
Yeah, that'd be great. And speaking of getting out of the classroom, we wrote a great book called Take Back the Magic, which really helps people about having conversations with the dead. Could you tell us a little bit about that book and what inspired you to write it?
Sure. So my practice of collaborating with the dead was very personal and very private for a long time. I've been on a spiritual quest, I suppose, ever since I was a small child. I grew up in a, you know, atheistic, bohemian, materialistic, capitalist family. And so, of course, I had spiritual fascination. And that led me to a 2-day conversion to Catholicism, to a long time journey into Zen and Tibetan meditation. I ended up marrying a man who'd been a former Rinzai Zen master. And we both began really to become, we were both interested very much in climate change. And what was the spiritual response to this moment? This, we were asking this question 30 years ago. And for me, it became more and more about this very private experience of the dead that blew open 12 years ago for me through an encounter I had with an extraordinary psychic. I wrote a book with her called The Reluctant Psychic. She was a woman, Robert. She'd be a great person to have on your show. And plus, she's the funniest person I know in the whole world.
I should say, just on some of my podcasts, I've noticed little blips, little kind of markers on Perdita's audio. When I play it at normal, I don't hear anything, but it shows up. And if I amplify it, I don't know, some of them have a sound. Like this one just said, yes.
She had to train herself as a child to tell the living and the dead apart. And she even now, she sometimes has a hard time telling the difference. She was very fragile, as you can imagine, in day-to-day life. I'd been talking to the dead and working with them for 20 years, and I had a very sick child that the doctors couldn't diagnose. And I considered myself, my father had been a doctor, and I assumed you could find the best specialist and pay him some money and get an answer and get the right medicine and all would be well. And we were going to the best doctors in New York and Boston, and all they could tell us was that our kid was really, really sick and they didn't know why.
It's horrible.
And in the midst of it, we'd spent all of our money and all of our savings and remortgaged our house to go to all these doctors. And in the midst of it, we lost our primary clients as writers. And so we were broke and our kid was sick and I felt hopeless. And I was at the gym one day and I was so angry. Both my parents were dead at this point. And I kept thinking, like, if my father was alive, he'd know the specialist in Boston to go to. He'd know the guy, you know, it's always a guy. And I just felt so helpless. And this old woman came up to me and said, Perdita, you need to go see this psychic. And I just thought, oh, I hate living in Woodstock. You know, that was my first thought. I want to go to a psychic. I want to go to a doctor. But I came home and my daughter looked at me and she said, Mom, my bones hurt so bad. I want to get out of my body. And I didn't know what to do. So you'll do anything when your kid hurts. So I took my scientific logical mind and tucked it in my back pocket and went down to this store in town where I was told you could find the psychic she didn't advertise. And I walked in and no one seemed to be in the store. And then this tiny little woman appeared with a shock of blonde and purple hair and tiny black eyes. And she said, okay, come in the back room. That's all she said to me. And I said, my kid's sick. She said, yeah, I know. And she looked at me and she said, oh, your parents are here. And she said, your mom, Patricia, right? And she had a big white Persian cat. And she used to live in your daughter's room and she lived with you. And, oh, she wants you to know she's still there. And she holds your daughter all night long so you can get some sleep.
Huh.
And then she said, now, my father was an emergency room doctor. And growing up, this was in the days before pagers and cell phones, he would answer our family telephone like this, Robert. Will you forgive me if I curse? Because this is what he would do. He would answer the phone going, what is it this time? That's how he answered the phone. It might be my friend. It might be a teacher. It might be some lovely parent calling about a bake sale. And that's how my father answered the phone. He was so stressed out. So I'm in this psychic's room and she says, excuse me, your father is here. And I apologize. I don't like to use language like this, but he says, Perdita, what is it this time?
Wow.
And Robert, that was the moment when my reality turned inside out. I think until that moment, I'd been fantasizing or that I was imagining my relationship with the dead. I didn't realize the dead were real. They were there. Their personalities were there. Their presence was there. And what she told me was that my father knew that the person who was going to get us through my daughter's illness was not a doctor, but this psychic.
Huh.
And he got me to her.
Wow.
And so the book, as you can imagine from that short story, I had a very complicated relationship with my father. He cut me out of his will before he died, and we had a very fraught relationship. But the book is about how I healed with him and also about how I began to teach other people how to collaborate with the dead and how I collaborated with the dead on this journey with my daughter.
Now, did you see or experience the dead the same way that the psychic did?
Oh, no, not at all. You know, she can't tell the difference between a living person and a dead person when she walks into a room. She has to see if their feet are touching the ground or if their clothes are right. For me, it's, quote, my imagination. Someone pops into my head. So I, the other day, thought about my high school French teacher. She popped into my head for no reason, right? And I was just kind of remembering, like, I was not very nice to her, and I was sort of feeling bad about it.
We interrupt this program for another EVP. I don't know. This one, take a listen, see what you think. Could be nothing, but wasn't a breath.
And I thought, I wonder what ever happened to her. And I looked her up, and she had died on that day the year before. So my thinking about her, she was thinking about me. We were both thinking about each other. And it was a sign that I wanted to collaborate with her and remember her and play with her and talk to her. And I printed out a photograph of her, which I put on my ancestor altar, and invited her to help me go on this trip to France I was getting organized to go on. And it felt like a moment of connection. And what I try to teach people to do is how to trust our intuition and our imagination again, which are both psychic powers.
Yeah, where is the line from intuition to perception? Because that's a big bridge, right, for people to cross. Because perception, you start to believe it. Intuition is you think it's telling you something, but perception is you perceive it and it's more real. EVP alert. I promise, I'll only do a few of these. This one sounded like help. I've heard a couple, and if they don't make sense to me, I don't put them in. But this one sounded like help. So here it is.
Well, I think in an age of scientific and religious fundamentalism, and we have both, right? We want proof, right? We want tangible materialistic proof of these things. We want technicolor miracles. We want explosions and of proof. We want everybody to see the sun turning in the sky and all kinds of things. And in fact, frequently the dead prove to us they're there, but the proof they offer is only for us because it's an intimate relationship. And I think as modern people, we are out of touch with intimacy too.
No, that's definitely true, and guilty over here. If you don't mind, there's one thing I think I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, how is your daughter? And we don't have to keep this in the interview, but how is your daughter today? I assume it's been maybe 15 or 20 years since she's that time.
It's been 13 years since she got sick. My daughter is, her name is Sophie Strand, and she's a very famous writer now.
Oh, that's awesome.
And she writes about illness and disability in the environment. She's a very, very successful and powerful writer and speaker. She, unfortunately, her journey has been very complicated, Robert. And the psychic was the person who could guide us with. We went on pilgrimage, my husband and myself, to the Black Madonna of Our Lady of Broken Medora. And when we came back, we finally found a doctor who could diagnose her. People had thought she had Lyme disease or this or that. And she has a very severe form of a collagen disorder called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome that is neither curable nor treatable.
And so how does she cope day to day? I mean, it sounds like her illness was her muse in a way. Is she able to be out of pain or?
No. No, she's in terrible pain. It's sometimes compared to bone cancer is one of the most painful syndromes you can have. But I will say that she does not take any pain medicine. And, you know, I believe in prayer, and I wrote a book on prayer with my husband. And, you know, you learn about prayer in moments of extremity when we live so much in a monetary economy that we have forgotten how to navigate the economy of prayer. But when there's pain and hopelessness, you learn a different way of operating in the world.
So you're not religious by nature, correct? But you do believe in the power of the rosary and prayer though. That's interesting, I think.
So I am, not only am I not religious, Robert, I am dead set against most religions. I'm an equal opportunity employer when it comes to all priestly hierarchies. Okay. Yep. So I'm not really interested in institutional authority or institutional homogenous belonging or dominance hierarchies of any kind. My husband and I founded a group called The Way of the Rose, which is our motto is ecology, not theology. And we are devoted to the rosary. I have prayed the rosary. I didn't know how to explain how a brief ex-Catholic, raised atheist, sometimes Zen Buddhist was praying the rosary. But my husband and I both began to explore the bead practices are probably the oldest spiritual tradition in the world. And they exist in every religion around the world. And they exist before religion. Religion is an invention of about 10,000 years ago. But our ancestors were making beads 150,000 years ago. And they were making them through climate crises of all kinds, you know, super eruptions and ice ages and tsunamis. And what they did was they learned how to use mantric prayer and holding on to this umbilical cord of beads, which is like a breast or like the nipple, that would console them and guide them. And so we have written a kind of radical book about what we call, you know, earth devotion. And how do we take our bearings from the earth instead of the dominant culture?
So the rosary to you is very much grounded in nature and Mother Nature, I guess, on the earth, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
And it was for medieval people as well. You know, if you look at medieval villages in Europe, you know, in the 12 or 1300s, they've done DNA tests, and some of the people in those villages go back 8,000 years. So these were people, and nobody could read or write, not even the priests. So they're nominally Christian. They're barely Christian. Yeah, you want me to call the Mother Goddess Mary? Sure, I'll call her whatever you want me to call her. You know what I mean? Like, you know. So they were very, very nominally Christian, but they did have tremendous devotional energy to the mother. And in the Middle Ages, what you see before the Enlightenment, before the Reformation, is the remnants of these old earth devotions that people had and that had guided them through the seasons, lifetime upon lifetime.
Wow, that's amazing. And so, you know, do you believe when we pass, it's the mother figure that greets us more often, or do you think and we should probably we should probably step back first and define the dead. You talk to the dead.
Can I answer the mother question?
Sure.
The dead question?
Yep.
Okay, great. So I have a friend. Her name's Julie Ryan.
Julie Ryan has been on this show. She's a medical scanner.
Oh, you're kidding. Oh, I love Julie. She's just one of my dearest friends. And I adore Julie. And one of the things that's really helpful is, you know, Julie sees people when they're about to pass, right?
Yep.
And the way she can tell someone is about to pass is their mother shows up.
Yes.
And not the mother, not the great mother, but their actual mother. But I believe that all of our mothers and all of our past lives show up as we're dying, that what we experience as a departure on this side is really a reunion on the other. This past summer, my father-in-law died. And as happens, when he was getting close, he was 91 and he had, you know, he was home and we were all there with him. He began to see his mother. He began to talk about that he was being invited to go to a garden party. And he said, should he go? And we said, if he wanted to go, he should go to the garden party, you know. But at the very end, he said he saw a woman in the room. And my husband and I said, yeah, tell us about her. And he said, she's like no woman I've ever seen before. And he said, she's going to burn the whole thing down.
Oh God.
I know, right? Well, so he got Kali just before he died. You know what I mean? Like, but yeah, I think we see our mother, and you know, I find that consoling. I find it consoling to realize that I'm in relationship to the dead, and I'm going to now transition to your other question about who are the dead and what are they? And I talk about the dead and not our ancestors because I want to liberate my thinking about the other side from biological lineage. And I want to think about all the many, many different souls that my soul is entangled with. And, you know, if I think about who I love that's on the other side, of course, they're family members and grandparents and great-grandparents, but they're also pets, teachers, neighbors. And they're also strange dead that I don't even know my connection to. So I'm coming up out of the subway and there's a homeless man on the sidewalk dying just as I come out of the subway and the EMTs are just arriving. And I find myself on my knees praying as this man dies in front of me. And he's on my altar. And there are dead all around us and beneath us. What I often say to people is, go outside wherever you are and imagine this as you listen to this and pick up a handful of dirt. I don't care if you're in the city or the country or the suburbs, get some dirt in your fingers and look at it and think about it because that dirt is nothing but the bodies of the dead. It's the bodies of trees and plants. It's the bodies of insects and animals. It's the bodies of stones that come from vanished oceans. In my own backyard, there are bits of stone with shells in them from oceans that formed the Catskills 350 million years ago. The dirt is the dead. And we plant seeds in the dirt to make them grow. And we plant our prayers in the dirt of the dead. They begin to grow. The dead are everywhere, and we stand atop their bodies. And when I talk about the dead, I am talking about all the dead who have ever been, lifetimes upon lifetimes. One of my favorite books recently, it's called Other Lands by Thomas Halliday. And he goes back and back through epochs of time, through vast extinctions, through, you know, hundreds and hundreds of millions of years of lifetimes on this planet. And all of those dead are beneath our feet. And all of those dead are available to us and want to collaborate with us. When people die, what I've come to see is they don't lose their personalities, but they do shift their perspective. And my psychic friend used to say that the first thing they say when they die is like, oh shit, I didn't realize, you know. Oh, the story is bigger and more interesting than I knew. But I think what we begin, the perspective is we begin to see how entangled all of our souls are with each other and how we're always coming and going from the land of the living and the land of the dead, always changing places. It's sort of like Jacob's vision in the Old Testament, right? Going up and down that ladder back and forth to heaven, like, you know, like DNA, always coming and going.
Yeah.
And so the dead is everyone.
Yeah, speaking of the dead, my dog is groaning at my feet. Hopefully you're not hearing that coming through. I know you have your cat. We talked about this before. You have your cats in the other room. My dog, she sounds like an old lady when she groans, you know, it drives me up a wall. But yeah, that's a great description of the dead. So it sounds like they're humans. You've talked on other podcasts about helpers, the dead being helpers. And mm-hmm. that sounded to me a lot like what a lot of people call angels. Do you believe in angels, or are the dead just people who lived before us who have a connection and want to help us in this existence?
Well, I think one of the things that's important to know about where we stand as modern people is that that conversation with the dead on the other side is a ubiquitous conversation among hunter-gatherer peoples and indigenous peoples, has been actively silenced to create the world we live in. And that's pretty well documented. During the European gynocide, it's often called the witch craze, the single thing that people could most be tortured and killed for doing was speaking to the dead. That's been documented by Anne Barstow, who's one of the great scholars on the witch craze. But it was speaking to the dead that was the most dangerous thing, not herbalism, not midwifery, that conversation. And why in the movement towards a materialist, corporate, capitalist world we live in, did we need to silence the dead? You know, it's just like Descartes was cutting out the vocal cords of the animals he was experimenting on. Why we had to silence the voices of the whole other side in order to destroy the world the way we've done as modern people. So the voices of the dead were silenced. And you find, you know, I think in religions that still have rootstock in paganism, you find the conversation with the dead. So in Catholicism, you find the veneration of the saints. In Hinduism, you, of course, also find a similar relationship to the saints and the kind of ubiquitous. I often think our ancestors just didn't experience gods or goddesses, angels or entities. They experienced the living and the dead, always changing places. And not always changing places from human body to human body, but human body to animal body. So that one moment your grandmother is your grandmother, and the next she is the deer who's come to feed you. Mm. And people recognize this. You find this in these cultures. They knew they were eating those they love. In the Jataka tales about Buddhism, there's stories about the Buddha incarnating as, you know, a rabbit to feed a hungry traveler or an animal to feed someone who's starving to death. But this wasn't a special thing for our ancestors. This is what everybody was doing. We were constantly feeding each other with our bodies. We were constantly taking care of each other, one side, one place. Tyson Yunkaporta, the Aboriginal elder in his book Sand Talk, describes that how for his people, the word for great-grandmother is the same as the word for child. You recognize that everybody's just recycling. And what happens when we live in a world where we're not going to get out of it alive? How would we be treating this earth if we knew we were returning to it? So many baby boomers my age think they're going to age out climate change. You're going to be reborn right in the thick of it.
Oh, boy. Beyond animals, what about like plants or trees? I mean, can you talk about that a little bit?
I've had lifetimes as trees. I love trees. You know, I think we all have different relationships to different creatures and beings and souls. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think we kind of know it. You know, I have a friend and I call her the hummingbird and she calls me the oak tree. And, you know, and it's playful. We joke because she travels all over the world and she never sits still. And I'm always in Woodstock whenever she shows up. And here I am rooted to this place. And, you know, I have a tremendous intense relationship to trees, but I know people who have intense relationship to fungi and mushrooms or this being or that being. And I think we have affinities, just like we have affinities for different time periods. We have affinities to the experiences of other beings. And I think that it's wonderful to cultivate them too, right?
Yeah.
That's where wisdom comes from.
Do trees sense and feel a lot more than humans do? I have a sense like humans, like our limbs are like deadened, you know, to what's like immediately around us.
I think everything on the planet thinks and feels more than humans do.
All right. Okay.
I think we're really hopeless, but not hopeless. Here's the thing. We have a lot of animals in our house. We love animals. And we also rescue. I used to do wildlife rehabilitation. So we raised like baby possums up in the bedroom. And we have a lot of animals. And a friend came and said, you know, it's so sweet how you give all your animals little personalities. And after she left, one of my kids turned to me and said, it's so sweet how we give, you know, this friend a little personality. Anyone who lives with animals knows they have personalities. And
I think I was going to inject one thing, if you don't mind, Perdita. I think animals, or at least dogs, I mean, I don't know about cats, but I've had guests that were pet psychics, you know, or that's part of what they did. And I think, you know, animals, and I believe this, unlike humans, we're kind of like in a plane afraid to jump out of it when death approaches, right? But animals, they see it as dogs. I mean, I believe this, there's no hesitation. They run into the next green pasture, happy to leave their pain behind and just be happy at the next place. So I've kind of come to the belief that animals are less afraid of death and don't dwell on it as much as humans do. We're probably the only species that does that.
I agree with you, Robert, and I agree with you so deeply. And I've learned so much from being with my animals as they died. I mean, I feel like they've taught me so much about death and dying and how to do it with grace. And I also want to be an animal again. I want to remember the animal way of death. One of my favorite books is by this UVM professor, and it's called Life Everlasting, The Animal Way of Death. And it's really about how an animal dies. You know, you don't find corpses of animals out in the woods because somebody eats them pretty fast, you know.
Yeah.
And St. Francis, when he was dying, begged his monks to take him out and lay his body on the ground for the animals to feed them with his body. Of course, they didn't. But in a lot of folk traditions, they say that as we're dying, animals approach, the animals we've loved come to help us cross.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned you were a tree and your favorite books. One of my favorite books that I actually gave to my mom, and before we hit the live record switch, we were both talking about how our moms had dementia, how kind of tough that was to go through the long, slow goodbye and how they don't recognize you and how that's kind of defeating. But one of the books I got her was by Sidney Sheldon. The Giving Tree was one of my favorite books, and I gave it to her as a gift. And when she passed, my father gave it back to me, you know. But to me, that was what Mother was. Are you familiar with The Giving Tree book by Sidney Sheldon?
Oh, I know it very well. I mean, I have mixed feelings about that book as a mother.
Okay.
So, you know what I mean? Like,
okay, it's just,
I feel like
wow.
A little too much Giving Tree sometimes.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. If we're all mother trees, men and women, young and old, if we can all remember that we've been each other's mothers for innumerable lifetimes, that mother is something that's a word for me that's beyond gender, beyond species even, what a different world we would live in. What if our generals and our politicians thought of themselves and remembered that they were mothers? What if we could remember that we've all been each other's mothers and we've all been each other's children, lifetimes upon lifetimes? And the reason for me that I want to access those memories of past lifetimes is not to, you know, remember I was Cleopatra or a princess in a castle or some BS like that, but I want to remember what it feels like to have my soul entangled with so many other souls, that nobody's ever alone. And I want to know what my responsibilities are so that I come out of the subway and someone's dying. And yeah, the person who's dying there may have been my child in another life. My responsibility in that moment is to hold that man's hand and to be with him and to pray with him. It's a mystery to me why that happened, but I hold him in my heart. Does that make sense?
Yeah. You know, I tend to think humans have both a good and evil, right? It sounds like you also believe that we all have a feminine or a great mother aspect in us as well. And right after that, you probably didn't hear, it was very low on Perdita's track. It was a sound that sounded like, so what? So what? Take a listen.
Sure.
To me, that is also another word for that could be compassion. Is it fair that a lot of the compassion and empathy in us is the mother?
It is. You know, people always ask me, do I believe in evil? And I always say, I think everyone on the other side is a saint. They remember our mothers, even those people who are awful in this life.
Huh.
I fear the living desperately. I'm not scared of ghosts. I am terribly frightened of reasonable men in boardrooms making reasonable decisions.
Yeah, a lot of spiritual people say the same thing. On my 97th episode so far, I hear that a lot.
I'm sure you do. It's very common. It's not, and you know, sometimes people feel frightened of the way spirits try to get our attention. But we're so shut off to these conversations that they often have to use dramatic methods to get our attention. You know, my son was having, you know, oh my gosh, you know, he was pre-med in college, and my crazy mother is talking to dead people all the time. And he was home from college and he was alone in the house and in the dining room, which is adjacent to our kitchen. We have a huge ancestor altar with photographs of all my beloved dead. And it was a quiet day, not a breath of wind in the house. And he's, you know, making himself a sandwich. And all of a sudden, every single photo on the ancestor altar fell off the altar onto the ground. Huh. And not a one of them broke. But he knew. He said, all right, I get it. They're trying to get my attention.
Wow.
They are. They just want to work with you. They just want you to acknowledge their presence. We all want to be acknowledged.
Have you ever been to Lilydale in New York and upstate?
No, I haven't. I long to go. It's a place I haven't been.
I got to tell you, it's kind of on an energy vortex. I've been there a couple times. I did three episodes actually on it when I went there a couple summers ago. Upstate New York, it's a spiritualist community. It's a hamlet. Think of a town with like 40 psychics living there, right? And they open it up during the summer and there's a lot of classes you can take, and they have this main type of auditorium area where there's some very interesting people that talk and give lectures. But it's funny. When I go there, I feel like very calm. But then as I'm driving home, I start getting the feeling again of the angst of the real world. But I think you would really like it, Perdita.
Well, let me talk about the angst about the real world, Robert, because the way I work with the dead is all about it. So I begin my morning, every morning. My husband and I, our kids are grown now. But that doesn't mean you stop worrying about them. You're a parent, you know, you do nothing but fret about your children. And we sit there having our coffee and we fret and we worry. And what we do is we call upon the dead we know and we assign them our worries. We assign to each of our dead our worries, a particular worry, and we turn them over. And it's the best anti-anxiety medicine in the whole world. And it works. And the thing is, the dead can get stuff done that the living can't imagine. What I do in my workshops and what I talk about in my book is show people how to day to day collaborate with the dead in all aspects of your life. We're so anxious as modern people. We feel so alone and so overwhelmed. We feel we're isolated from families, from community, but most of all, we're isolated from our helpers on the other side. I told you that I love the title of this podcast, because you stop being so frightened when you have the dead at your back. You know, they're there. They got you.
Angels are, you know, that what a lot of people call angels, you believe they're really kind of people that have lived before, but they're the ones that are there on the other side that want to help you, that still have a connection with you. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think what we call angels today are really just ancestral spirits on the other side.
Okay. Right.
Here's the thing. I do believe there are beings that are too big for our imagination. Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
I believe that there's a lot more than we know about and can see, just like there are beings that are too small for our imagination. You know, my husband, who's a poet, once said, you know, how many souls can fit inside a firefly?
Yeah.
You know, it's that Doctor Who moment, right? When the smallest thing is the biggest thing. And what happens when time and space are folded all over each other? I don't know. I live a lot inside the mystery. I like to say that I'm part of a mystery religion, which is I'm not part of the Enlightenment. I'm part of the Endarkenment. I don't know a lot. But what I do know is that I'm loved and I'm held. And because I know that I'm loved and I'm held and I experience it, I'm able to be more loving to other people in a day-to-day experience of my life.
And when you talk about the dead, is there one other side or are there multiple other sides?
Well, again, that's one of those great mysteries, isn't it? You know, my favorite vision, I get a little tired of his Christian piety, but I love C.S. Lewis's sort of visionary impulse. And in one of his books, The Magician's Nephew, I don't know if you've ever read the Narnia books he wrote, he describes these children. They there are these row houses in London, and the children discover that all the attics are connected so that they can walk through the attics and descend into any house they want. And in one of the attics, they discover this magical item that transports them to a place called the Wood Between the Worlds. And in that wood are ponds everywhere. And whatever pond they step into brings them into a different universe and a different world. And the Wood Between the Worlds and that attic area was, I think, C.S. Lewis' attempt to try to explain and envision what the Tibetans call the Bardo realm, the places in between. The Tibetans, of course, have their, you know, technological formulas for navigating the Bardo that are always about maintaining wealth, as all religions do.
Yeah.
But I do think that there is something to be said about the in-between, what the in-between is. And I don't think time and space are linear. I mean, I'm somebody who has a lot of precognitive dreams, for instance, that I've been fascinated by. You know, I got into psychoanalysis in my 20s because I was sort of overwhelmed by my precognitive experiences.
I was going to ask you about that, Perdita, because you mentioned about when you were awake, how you talked to the dead. I was wondering if you had dreams that they visited you as well.
Yeah, I'm an intense dreamer with the dead. And I didn't know it until I was about 40 years old, that in fact, I was really traveling in my dreams. And I really could travel and I could really see people and meet people and I could see things before they happened. And it frightened me until I learned how to navigate it. And I think that navigating the Bardo is not dissimilar to that. I mean, that's something else I've learned to do. And I think you can learn to do, like you say, when you go to Lilydale, like these are skill sets you can get better at. And I think they used to be ubiquitous skill sets. Part of my book, Take Back the Magic, is it's a story about how I healed with my father, but it's also a love story about my husband and me.
Mm.
We've shared many lifetimes together. And we share many memories from those lifetimes. And we want to keep finding each other. My name means Perdita, which means lost. But my husband, the first thing he said when he met me, he said, did you know that Perdita is the lost island of paradise in Celtic mythology?
Wow.
And so,
that's great.
And so I was found by him. A lot of us feel lost in our culture. And we want to learn how to find each other again. And we want to find our bearings in that long story where no one is ever lost to us. And no one we've ever loved is ever lost to us. We'll find each other again and again and again.
So what do you think if a person buys your book, Take Back the Magic, or goes and attends your workshops? Do you have workshops like online, in person, or how does that work?
I do a lot of, I have a big workshop coming up starting in August with the Shift Network. I'm going to be offering an extended version of my introductory course through Shift starting in August. It's on Tuesdays, but again, it's recorded sessions. I also have a website, wayoftherose.org and takebackthemagic.com. I'm revamping takebackthemagic.com in preparation for my book publication, but I'll be posting my workshops through the whole next year and the coming weeks. And so I offer a lot of different workshops. I offer an introductory workshop. I talk about how to work with the saints, workshops on working with what I call the long story of our souls, reincarnation. And I do extended year-long workshops with people working very intensely on collaborating with the dead. It's very simple. On the one hand, what I teach people is the dead are real and they want to help you and they want to collaborate with you. That's it. That's the sum total. You could take that, do it yourself.
Do people want to talk to the dead when they're like on death's doorstep? Or what are the most common types of people that come to you that want to take your workshops and learn how to communicate with the dead?
Everyone's having these experiences. And the most common thing people say to me, Robert, is, I know this sounds crazy, but, and I know that this was my father who helped me. I know this was my grandmother who showed up. And they want confirmation. And they want confirmation that their experience of the other side is real. And that's the most common thing. Now, do people who've had heartbreak show up? Yes. I think often when we've had really profound heartbreak, we become more open to these experiences. But all kinds of people come to me. I will have in my workshops people from age 18 to 85. I'm telling you, it's amazing. And the thing that really makes a difference is what I call in shifting our belief sphere is having friends. It's like your radio show. That's what you're doing with it. You're helping people open up to other ways of looking at the world. And that's kind of all I want to do too, is like, what if? How about it? What if this is real? So many people are having these experiences, but we're frightened at them. And we don't need to be.
Yeah. Boy, I got to tell you, Lilydale is a place for you. I just, only because the people like you teach that, you know, and it's interesting. Many of them don't believe in reincarnation, believe you just have one life. Others believe in reincarnation. So it's not like totally strict. It's a very spiritualist community. And it's very interesting, the different people that you meet. But there are a lot of people such as yourself that do courses, whether they're virtual or live there. So yeah, it'd be interesting. And I would just love to see, if you email me, if you ever go out there and visit there, because the summertime is when they start. They have a paranormal weekend, I think, in after the 4th of July or something.
I take proddings from the living seriously, knowing they're coming from the dead. So I'm going to have to go. I'm going this summer.
Yeah, I think you like it. You and your husband both. And maybe you'll meet people and, you know, and who knows? There's a great ghost walk. I one of my episodes was with a gentleman, Pastor Ron. I'm going to butcher his last name, Skaronski. Really good guy. He takes you through a 3-hour ghost walk, but really it's a spiritual walk. There's even like a fairy trail where people sometimes get pictures of fairies. I don't know if you believe in that, but it, like at the night or whatever.
Again, I think fairies, like angels, are just ancient ancestral and ancient ancestors. You know,
yeah.
I think we're just talking about the ancestor. But Julie Ryan and I this summer are getting together, the most haunted place I've ever been. So my in-laws live in Alabama, and I was telling her about the most haunted place I'd ever been, which is in Alabama.
Really?
Turns out to be an hour and a half from where she is, and we're going to meet there together this summer. So I will let you know how it goes.
That's great. There's another place out. I just interviewed a guy in this last episode about the Columbia River Gorge in Washington State, and there's some crazy stuff out there.
I've been there. But you know, here's the thing. The dead are everywhere. And
right after she says the dead are everywhere, small little thing on Perdido's audio file sounds like the dead.
You know, there are places, I suppose, that I, you know, for reasons I don't understand geologically and astrologically, that collect energy in different ways. But the dead are everywhere. There's nowhere you can go that the dead are not beneath you. And there is no graveyard that you can go to. You know, when my son was in college, he would never be ready when I went to pick him up for, you know, vacation. And so I would always go wait in the graveyard.
Yeah.
And I would just go, I love to read the names out loud because the dead like to hear their names said out loud. And I began to realize that there were certain names that I remembered when I wasn't there.
Wow.
And I would be worried about my son. And I would just call on the names of those dead in the graveyard to keep an eye on him when I was worried. And it's funny, he graduated 5 years ago now, and I still call on those same dead people to go in and take care of him. He's got his little team. We put a team together, and I happened to be near his college, and I went to visit them the other day. We don't know how we're all connected to each other. But the thing is, the dead are everywhere, and they're all there for you. Not just your relatives. And they'll show up. They'll tell you their names. They'll send you photographs. I mean, I talk about all this in my book.
Why do they care about us? Why do they want to help us?
Because they remember they've been our mothers.
Say that again. Well, sorry.
Everyone on the other side remembers that we've all been each other's mothers.
Okay. All right.
I often say, we know how much we've loved each other. And I think our hearts break to realize that we've lived without knowing it. What does it mean to know that? What does it mean to really live with the knowledge of how intimately we've cared for each other through vast epochs of time? The dead love us. I want to remember while I'm alive what the dead know on the other side.
And do you have any idea of what it's like on the other side in terms, like here it's like air, right? And I hear a lot on the other side, it's consciousness, which is a different level of atmosphere. Have you ever experienced that, or is it mostly just kind of the connections, the messages?
We all do. I heard Rupert Sheldrake give you must know Rupert Sheldrake. He gave a wonderful talk about this once. And
yeah,
I think every night we have this experience.
You die every night. Yeah.
We die every night. Every single night we're traveling in the Bardo. And, you know, we make sense of it when we wake up. And I do believe people who can help us explore our dreams are very helpful. You know, Robert Moss is a person who's done gorgeous work with that. And if you want to know what it's like to die, we go to that place in our dreams. And think about how you feel when you go to sleep at night, like how delicious it can be to go to bed when you're exhausted. I think, you know, a lot of us get there, right? I hope I get there where, oh, I'm ready to go to bed.
For me, and this is kind of interesting, the past couple nights or weeks, I like when I go to bed, I need to stretch out. I'm constantly stretching. And I don't know if that's just a weird like nervous leg syndrome or rest or whatever, but I'm stretching and getting comfortable. And then when I wake up, most recently, the dreams I've had have been I've traveled someplace. I'm having a very hard time getting back home. Like there's always, you know, and I don't quite know what that means, but it's like, you know, when you travel a lot now, there's canceled flights and delays and all that stuff. But I've had kind of the intense thing where I have a hard time getting home.
Oh, I hear you, Robert. I hear you. I call that getting the bends. You know, like when you come up from diving too fast.
I've heard about it, but I haven't done it. Yeah.
No, I haven't. I I'm not called to do. But I imagine I sometimes feel like, oh, it is sometimes hard to get out of that world. I'm so grateful that I have the luxury of not having to wake up to an alarm clock so I can wake up slowly and move out of that. I think that's another thing about the modern world is that people used to move out of the dream space very, very slowly.
Yeah, I appreciate that because I work from home, thank God. And I'll wake up at 6 and I'm like, all right, I have 2 hours before I really have to get up and start doing stuff. And I kind of savor that time. I really appreciate it.
And I think it's important. There's so much, and you know, we know so little about dreaming and consciousness. I mean, it's really we talk about exploring space and the galaxies, but we don't understand consciousness at all. Does consciousness live inside our heads? Apparently not, you know?
Yeah, we had talked also before I hit record. We had a really good conversation. One of your neighbors, Bob Berman, who's an astronomer and he's an author. He wrote a book with Dr. Robert Lanza called Biocentrism. Have you ever read that? Because I think a lot of that might align with what.
That's not.
I mean, in a nutshell, it's our consciousness creates reality versus the other way around. And in the documentary, he talks about really some great examples of, you know, how can we think that this miracle of life happened where all this stuff happened and everything had to happen just right for us to have consciousness, you know? He quoted someone, I forget who it was, but it's like a tornado going through a junkyard and creating a 747. How does that happen?
I think one of the most spiritual books I've ever read is Diane Ackerman's A Natural History of the Senses. And we think our own experience and perceptions are so determinate that we're seeing and hearing reality. But, you know, a dog or a bear is smelling the world in a way we can't imagine. A deer is seeing the world in a way we can't imagine. A bat is seeing a different world. Like there's so many ways of being in the world. That's why I really like prefer the mystery of it all. What I'm interested in, the intimate relationships I can have with other souls and other beings. I don't know that I need to master anything or understand anything.
This could be a breath, but it did sound like help if you listen to it. The other breaths I've taken out from Perdita don't quite sound like this. This sounded almost like the word help. So I just throw it in here for observation. And again, this is only on Perdita's wave file.
I don't understand love, but I'm trying to be good at it even so.
Yeah. It's funny. At the start of this, I mentioned Perdita Finn to me was like a mystery, a person who solves mysteries. And it's come up multiple times in this conversation. Now you love the mystery of life.
I didn't even talk about that. But I don't solve them. I think that's the thing. It's like, I do love mystery novels. But what does it mean to live in the I don't know? You know, right now in the modern world, everybody's taking sides about everything. Everyone's got opinions about everything, right? We stake out our sides. And how can we learn to live in the I don't know? I think about our ancestors sitting around a fire at night out in the woods. I love to go hiking and camping way out in the woods. And you make a campfire and that light can warm you and you can see a little bit by it, but it mostly reminds you how big the darkness is. And the darkness around us is very, very big. The darkness before we're born is big. The darkness after we die is big.
Why is that? Why is there so much darkness and so little light? I don't. Wow. It seems like it should almost be a yin yang.
He wrote a book called "Waking Up to the Dark" about darkness and human consciousness.
And another one. This one sounds like listen. So listen and see if you think it sounds like listen.
And it's a great book. I'll send it to you if you'd like. It's a really, really interesting research about lost experiences of consciousness in the darkness and what living in a light-addicted culture has done to our experience of our own minds.
Jeez, that's incredible.
Yeah, but when you think about it, most of the universe is dark matter. 80% of the universe is dark matter, and we don't know what it is.
Well, so in the ocean, right? A lot of the earth itself is unknown, right?
Yeah, and rather than see that as something to be afraid of or fearful of, what if that darkness is the same as the darkness as the womb where we gestate, as the darkness of the dirt where we plant the seed? Everything grows in darkness. We torture our prisoners by keeping the lights always on. And what if that great, I don't know, mystery, if we want to see a shooting star, we're never going to see it inside with the fluorescent lights. We have to step outside into the night. And that's where the miracles happen. That's where the magic happens.
Yeah, I think of like, instead of I don't know, I think from myself personally, I think if it's the truth, our whole life we're told untruths, whether it's Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny, or you're not going to, you know, when you start realizing you're going to die, that's when you start getting the truth. Then your whole life with what you're fed by the news and people around you, so much of it are untruths that when you find the truth, it's such a satisfying, good place. And I wonder for a lot of us, if the end reward of our journey in life is to finally find our own truth. Wouldn't that be nice?
Or maybe we could just learn the names of a couple trees and a couple flowers where we live. We're so disconnected from the body of the earth that's connected to our bodies. We don't really know the names of anything anymore. Our ancestors could have identified every plant that was in their native area, right? We don't even know the names of the beings that we're occupying space with. And
yeah,
I mean, that's why I often talk about I'm more interested in ecology than theology, because we are not in relationship to the stars and the moon and the sun and the rhythms of the seasons. And it's why, you know, people barely can recognize, you know, think, oh, it's great, there are no insects anymore. Like, people are so disconnected from their ecological experience. The truth is that nobody knows where they are anymore.
Yeah.
Nobody knows who they live with anymore. Nobody even knows the other souls that they're entangled with. So again, I want to come back to our relationship, our entangled relationships with each other, and how important they are, and how we can begin to cultivate them and be cultivated by them.
So, Perdita, don't you think part of the problem is ego? People want to know themselves, satisfy themselves, take care of themselves.
Exactly. We think the human mind is so important, our enlightenment, our individual. And the whole idea of the individual is such a silly idea anyway. You know, we're not, you know, what Walt Mittman said, I contain multitudes. Well, we all contain multitudes within us, multitudes of lives, multitudes of experience. And we're not alone. We don't have to be in control. You know, we've lived in the myth of human supremacy. And where has it gotten us but to the sixth extinction of all life on Earth? That's been a good experiment.
I know you have a lot of great things in your writings. Is there kind of a one or two takeaways of hope or positivity that you would leave us with?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. No one goes anywhere. Nothing we love is ever lost to us. We're all coming back. I think the wisest movie I've ever seen, the most spiritually profound movie, is Groundhog Day with Bill Murray. Have you ever seen it?
Yeah, and I heard you on a podcast, and I thought, is Groundhog Day really about like the long story of our soul, where you keep experiencing stuff over and over and over again, and until finally you find the truth or happiness that you want? I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, and so, you know, he's this guy, he's this weatherman who's condemned to live the worst day of his life over and over and over again, right? And Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, with this groundhog. And in our family, we joke, you know, well, what day is somebody on? Some people, you know, in the beginning, he thinks he's a god, right?
Yeah.
He can't die. And then he becomes depressed and despondent. And that doesn't work. And finally, he relents and just starts to think about who he is and what he wants. He takes a piano lesson. And he starts to stop trying to game everything or understand everything. And he starts to have fun. And he starts to play and be in relationship with other people. And of course, then everything comes to him. Love comes to him, and friendship comes to him, and art comes to him, and everything comes to him. But we go through these periods where we think we're gods, or we're great heroic despair, or this or that. And really, we'd have all the time in the world to get it right. Just like the dandelions, you know, they've been around for 35 million years. They got plenty of time to figure out how to get it right.
You know, it sounds like the secret of life is like the secret of death. You just need to let it unfold and accept it as it comes to you.
And know that there's enough time. Like, what would you do today if you knew you had all the lifetimes in the world to work with?
I'd take it slow.
Yeah. Be like Moss, right? Yeah. And you wouldn't feel like you had to achieve so much and be so frantic. And I think about my grandmother at 86. She took like a watercolor class at the library. You know, she raised six kids in the Depression. She had a gazillion grandchildren. Like, finally, she gets this watercolor class. How were her watercolors? Well, you know, they were okay. Yeah. I have one in my study. But the thing was, she arrived in her next life having already taken that class.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, that's a good message, too. Can you tell us again about your books that people might have interest in? You've written a couple of them, where they can buy them, and also, again, your website for some upcoming workshops that they may have interest in.
Absolutely. My book that's coming up that you can pre-order, and if you pre-order it, you will be invited to a free event with me. My publisher has figured that out, is Take Back the Magic, Conversations with the Unseen World. Pre-order it online at all major venues or at a local bookstore. And that'll be coming out on September 12th. And I have a book, The Way of the Rose, The Radical Path of the Divine Feminine Hidden in the Rosary. That a book I wrote with my husband. And I have a book, The Reluctant Psychic, which I wrote with Susan Saxman. You can find all those books at major publishers. The website right now that I use is wayoftherose.org. In 2 weeks, I will have my new website up for takebackthemagic.com. I also am on social media. You can follow me on Facebook or Instagram. I post a lot, and I also have a very popular Substack called Take Back the Magic, where people can interact with me about all of these matters. And I host a monthly Zoom meeting for people who subscribe to my Substack.
That sounds great. And your husband, sometimes on podcasts you're on together. What is your husband's name? So if people want to Google and hear both of you together on a podcast.
My husband's name is Clark Strand, and the book I was talking about that he wrote, and you might enjoy, I'll send you a copy of it, is Waking Up to the Dark, The Black Madonna's Gospel for an Age of Extinction and Collapse.
And let's show a plug for your daughter, too.
Her name is Sophie Strand, and she is Cosmogony on Instagram, and she wrote a book called The Flowering Wand, Reimagining the Divine Masculine. It comes from Inner Traditions. She has a novel coming out in August, and it's fantastic. It's like The Red Tent meets The Mists of Avalon. It's a feminist, sexy reimagining of the Gospels.
Much respect to her to be in pain and to be able to concentrate and write, which is one of the toughest things. You need your senses about you. So blessings to her.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for letting me tell everybody about all that, Robert. I really appreciate it.
Oh, cool. I hope people listen to it. And when you go check out Lilydale, send me a note and let me know what you thought.
I'm going to.
All right. Thank you for being on the show. I appreciate it.
I thank you, Robert. This has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you for the work you're doing in the world. I really appreciate it.
Been listening to the Afraid of Nothing podcast. Please subscribe and like us on Facebook. Until next time, stay scared.
Hey, you're still here? Great. Then why not listen to another episode? Visit afraidofnothingpodcast.com to peruse all the shows. That's afraidofnothingpodcast.com. And while you're there, click the coffee cup icon to buy me a coffee and leave a review. I'll give you a shout out in an upcoming episode, and the world will know how swell you are.